My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
It's just like a wall of awesomeness coming at you. That's how I would describe the whole album.
It's just been a lot of fun for me, Mike, to talk with you about this album at this moment.
It's something that everybody should hear at least once in their life.
It's fucking amazing!
You're listening to My Classic Album with Mike Norris.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of My Classic Album, looking back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris. Thank you for taking time out to join me for another episode of the show. I'm going to be joined by Tyler Baker today, who's the guitarist of a fantastic band from the US, Goodbye June. He's chosen an album, the second studio album to be precise, from Creedence Clearwater Revival, Bayou Country. Now, fans of the band will know that they actually released three studio albums in 1969, did CCR, and this was the first of those released in the January. Almost unheard of now, I guess, for a band to be releasing not only so many albums in such a short space of time, we're entering kind of Frank Zappa territory, but also, you know, of an amazing quality as well. I think that any of the three albums that they released in 69, so that would be Bayou Country that we're talking about today, Green River, or Willie and the Poor Boys, we could be talking about any of those albums today, and they'd be more than fitting to appear on My Classic Album. But it is Bayou Country that's getting the love today, and you'll hear my chat with Tyler in just a little bit all about this album. And, you know, it's a true classic that I'm looking forward to getting stuck into on the podcast, so that's coming up in just a little bit. Just wanted to take a quick minute to thank anyone who listened to our previous episode dedicated to Ozzy Osbourne's Blizzard of Oz album. I was joined by Sammy Boller for that one, who hugely influenced by Randy Rhoads, you know, and it's such a great conversation. I mean, I love Ozzy Osbourne and his solo output and his Black Sabbath stuff so much. So it was great to finally put a spotlight on that on My Classic Album. And it seems that you guys agreed as well. We got some really amazing feedback, a lot of love for the episode, to be honest. And, you know, if you want to see what episodes are coming up, if you want to kind of share your thoughts, there's loads of ways you can do that. Get yourself to the Facebook page, My Classic Album with Mike Norris, and like the page. We've just reached over 400 likes, which, you know, I'm really, really, like, considering this podcast just started as something that was just a bit of fun for me to geek out about music, the fact that people feel compelled to like the page and see what's going on with it is just something that we'll never get bored of. So thank you very much to everyone who's liking it over on Facebook. Similarly, Instagram's kind of heading for a similar milestone, My Classic Album podcast. Twitter, not so much, but then to be fair, I rarely grace the Twitter sphere. So, you know, I can't really blame that too much. I need to get better at Twitter. I've been saying this for years, but that's at @MCA_podcast. All of that information available at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk. All of our previous episodes are there, as well as on Podnose, which is the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. But, you know, any way that you want to leave feedback or just your thoughts on episodes or albums or whatever, Original Sunny Az did that on Instagram when we posted Blizzard of Oz. He said, "What could be better than your favorite guitarist reviewing your guitar hero and one of your most loved albums? Randy's been on a pedestal from the first time I heard him, and Sammy Boller blew me away when I discovered him. Truly enjoyed this episode. Thank you." So thank you for listening. You know, thank everyone for listening. You know, it's an absolute honor to chat with the kind of people that I do about the kind of albums that we're talking about, and that people enjoy it and love it and want to listen. So yeah, thank you so much to everyone. But absolutely, if you've got any thoughts about the podcast, anything at all, feel free to follow us on any of the social media pages, or perhaps even go to myclassicalbum.co.uk, click on contact. You can drop me an email there as well. That's absolutely fine. I'd love for you to do that, particularly over the next couple of weeks, because our next classic album, and this episode's due to go out at the start of May, will be celebrating 50 years of the Wishbone Ash album, Argus. Very special episode. I know that people kind of really enjoy the anniversary episodes when we do them. It's an album that might not have sold in the kind of levels of things like Hysteria and Nevermind and Rumours when we've done anniversary episodes in the past. However, it's a very, very influential album, particularly with the kind of bands and albums that we cover here on My Classic Album. So it seemed like an album that was worth celebrating and really getting stuck into. Dan Morris from Firekind chose the album. That was kind of how the wheel started turning. Martin Turner from Wishbone Ash, or formerly of Wishbone Ash, founding member, very much the visionary behind a lot of what you hear in Argus, will also be on the show sharing his thoughts and his memories as we approach 50 years of that album. 50 years, mad. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on it as well. So all those places, absolutely get in touch. Let me know what you think of this album. I know that there's some people, with it being such an influential album, but maybe a little under the radar for some people, perhaps outside of the UK. A few people have been saying to me, I've never actually heard this album before. I'd love to hear your thoughts too. Have a listen to it ahead of the podcast and let me know what you think. Let me know if you can hear these influences of bands like Iron Maiden and Thin Lizzy, who've openly said that this album was an influence for them. Check it out. It's a great album. But as usual, I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's just focus on today. Another fantastic guest, Tyler Baker from Goodbye June, and he has chosen the second studio album from Creedence Clearwater Revival, Bayou Country. But before we get to my chat with Tyler, as always, let's just have a look at those facts. Here's the beginning of what you need to know about Bayou Country. Bayou Country is the second studio album by American rock band Creedence Clearwater Revival. The first of three albums from the band in one calendar year, Bayou Country saw release on the 5th of January 1969. Creedence Clearwater Revival further evolved the swamp rock sound they'd established on their first album, released the previous year, allowing guitarist and vocalist John Fogerty to wear influences the likes of Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters firmly on his sleeve. Proud Mary was chosen as the single from the album, a song that would go on to be immortalised by Ike and Tina Turner. CCR's version reached number 8 on the UK Singles Chart and number 2 on the US Billboard Hot 100. As well as the Turners' rendition, Proud Mary has become a much covered and celebrated song, with both Tina's and CCR's versions finding a home in the Grammy Hall of Fame. Bayou Country ushered in CCR's first success in the UK, with the album reaching number 62 on the UK album charts. The album also saw the band's first top 10 album in the States, reaching number 7. Bayou Country certified 2x platinum in the US, becoming the first of three multi-platinum albums they would release before the end of the 1960s. With 1969 being a banner year for Creedence Clearwater Revival, Bayou Country is held in high esteem, along with Green River and Willie and the Poor Boys, as a document of a band reaching the height of their powers. Gilles Verlon named Bayou Country one of the 300 best albums in rock in 2013, while Robert Dimmery included it amongst his 1001 albums you must hear before you die in 2018. So that's just the beginning of everything we need to know about Bayou Country, and I have here with me my special guest who chose the album to talk about here on My Classic Album today. From Goodbye June, this is Tyler Baker. How are you doing?
Hey, what's up, Mike? How's everybody doing out there?
So, I mean, I know obviously we talked quite a bit about what album we're going to talk about today. Why have you chosen Bayou Country to talk about on the podcast this morning?
It was a vinyl that my dad had growing up that I just fell in love with, and it connected, for me personally, it connected a lot of dots, kind of genre, like the past, the blues, and then I think it has like a little punk in it. It was one of my main introductions to what you might call Southern music, even though, I mean, you know, John Fogerty, he was from Bakersfield, California, so he wasn't particularly like a Southern man, but that's just how I digested it. You know, I just assumed they were a Southern band just by, you know, Born on the Bayou and Bootleg and all those songs. So yeah, it's just, it was a very formative album for me. It was down and dirty, 7 songs. Left me wanting more, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know you were saying it was your dad's record. Do you have any memories of kind of hearing it, or in fact hearing Creedence Clearwater Revival for the first time?
Yeah, so he had 2 records. He had their greatest hits record that I absolutely loved, and then he had this one, and he had Bayou Country, and we played them both. I mean, just hearing this in context, we had a record player in our entertainment system that was in the living room. So that's where, you know, the heart of the house was. We were always in there and in and out, running around and whatever. But he would put on the records, and then you know, we might have the doors open in the house and we'd be running inside from playing or whatever. And he'd have CCR cranking, like, and we could hear it from outside while we were playing. It was just cool. It was good memories. And, you know, hearing this next to like Leon Russell, and he had Cream and he had all these really cool records. But just hearing Bayou Country, for some reason, it stuck with me.
And, you know, you've touched on this a bit already. So, you know, CCR, they were an integral band in the late 60s and 70s, but really quite a unique sound for that time period as well. Obviously, it sounds like it was the soundtrack to your childhood. What kind of influence would you say that they've, as a band, that they've had on yourself and the music of Goodbye June?
Well, I think everybody, every musician, every young musician has records that mean a lot to them. And there's sometimes records that when you hear it, you're like, holy crap, this guy kind of sounds like me a little bit. The moves he's doing on guitar, or the chord changes, or, you know, his phrasing or his staccato notes or what, you know, whatever, you know, wow, this kind of sounds like me. That's what I had at an early age with John Fogerty. Was me as a young musician, I could pick up, and the first time I heard Born on the Bayou, I was like, it made complete sense to me. And I kind of knew how to play it, you know, like I just like, and then like, it's not like I had to go. I mean, back then, you know, you had like Guitar World magazine, you had to try to find the tabs or whatever. Like, I didn't really have to do that with John Fogerty. All his music made sense to me. And like, so that was something like when I was listening to like somebody like ZZ Top or Lynyrd Skynyrd, that didn't come natural to me. Now, granted, John Fogerty's music is pretty simple. You know, it's kind of akin to Tom Petty sometimes, like in the chords and in the, you know, the simplicity of the music. But yeah, man, it just spoke to me immediately. So I think I immediately thought it was cool, which was weird because I was also listening to like 90s rap. Like, I was into Nas and Eminem had just come on the scene, and like I was listening to grunge music, you know, Nirvana, Soundgarden. That was what was cool, you know, in my social circles or whatever. But there's something about CCR that cut right through everything, and I always knew that was cool, and I always knew that music, you know, spoke to me. So to answer your question, I think it just kind of laid this nice foundation of music for me. I don't know, it was nice and warm and safe and awesome, and I could just put it on, and it was a jam, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, this album came out in 1969, which was a really productive year for the band. So Bayou Country was actually the first of three studio albums that they'd released that year. So there was Green River, and then Willie and the Poor Boys released as well. What would you say makes Bayou Country stand out amongst the three? And can you hear any kind of progression or evolution across those three albums kind of within that year?
I think you heard in this one, in Bayou Country particularly, there's a little bit, it's a little rougher around the edges. I think the songwriting is a little more raw. I mean, the songwriting in all three of those records are incredible. And like, I mean, that was kind of the year for CCR. But yeah, Bayou Country was the first one, right? So yeah. I think about my first record, and it's like, you know, is my first record the best record? I don't know. But when I hear my first record, I hear a bunch of young guns just throwing stuff against the wall and seeing if it sticks. And I kind of hear that same thing happening with Bayou Country, is even though it is their second, I think it was their second record, it still had that rawness of a first record. It still had that, urgency, as I call it.
And I mean, as we've said, you know, I think the band, there was something truly unique when you consider kind of what was going on in the American music scene at the time. So Backseat Mafia explained this really well. So they say that American rock music was an interesting place in the late 60s with the psychedelic sounds of the West Coast jam bands, a burgeoning singer-songwriter movement, arty outsider rock courtesy of the likes of Velvet Underground and the Silver Apples, as well as a roots rock movement that had been spearheaded by the band. One band who didn't seem to fit neatly into any of those movements were California's Creedence Clearwater Revival. So, I mean, I guess for the benefit of maybe those who are listening and maybe not familiar, maybe not around at the time, what do you think that these guys were bringing that was such an alternative to these bands like Velvet Underground or Grateful Dead or Joni Mitchell or whatever was going on at the time.
Well, there was, to me, like I said, they kind of, at least for me personally, they connected a lot of dots. Like, so there was like, so John Fogerty has this bravado when he's playing the guitar, kind of akin to like an old bluesman like Freddie King or something. And Freddie wouldn't have been that old at the time. Freddie probably would have been, I'm assuming, maybe a little older than Fogerty. Maybe like 15 years older than Fogerty, I would guess. But like, he's like, you know, Fogerty's kind of channeling this Freddie King, Albert King kind of just raw, awesome blues bass guitar. And then there's these elements of punk in the sense of the production's maybe not that great. It's just like a guitar through maybe like a clean amp, but that clean amp's cranked up and it's just punchy and kind of raw. So he's combining those two elements, and then obviously he's a powerhouse of a singer. So like, I think all of those elements combined led to something completely unique. And, you know, and they get thrown into Southern music a lot, but they weren't doing, like, to me, when I listen to those records, I don't think of like Lynyrd Skynyrd or ZZ Top, you know, those two, or 38 Special, you know, those kind of bands to me are Southern rock. You know, those were the flagship Southern rock bands at the time. Creedence Clearwater Revival is doing something different. They were doing something a little darker, a little swampier. I felt like the songwriting was really accessible and simple and like, you know, pop songwriting at the time. But it was like, it was just different. It didn't fall into the Southern styles.
Yeah. And I think, as we said, you know, it sounds like they were making quite an effort to be an alternative, particularly to those more kind of psychedelic. And I think I use Grateful Dead as an example, you know, those kind of psychedelic bands towards the end of the 60s. And you know, CCR made the decision to completely abstain from drugs. Drummer Doug Clifford told Goldmine in 2013, "We went to see the local bands and they were so stoned they weren't even in tune and they were really terrible. We made a pact on the floor of the Fillmore right then, where we would do no drugs or alcohol. We decided to get high on the music or get out of the business." And do you think there's an element of, you know, again, you know, not to rag on Grateful Dead, because that's certainly not the intention, but, you know, again, they would play these kind of really long psychedelic songs. As we've said, CCR's punchy, it's to the point, it's very focused. Do you think that maybe comes from that attitude, that it is about getting high on the music rather than anything else?
maybe. I mean, you know, I don't know, man. I mean, Clapton was pretty messed up at the time. Mm-hmm. He was doing a lot of drugs and he was creating incredible music. So,
yeah.
And Jimi Hendrix obviously is another example of somebody who's probably a drug enthusiast or connoisseur of the time. But like, I mean, I think to go to it, I mean, the songwriting's really sharp on this stuff. And like you said, the songs are to the point. I mean, there's a couple of jams, like I think Graveyard Train and Keep on Chuglin'. Those two songs are a little longer, kind of jam bandy kind of thing, like the band Let's Loose. But I mean, at the same time, this album was only 7 songs long. So it's like, they probably felt like they had to fill out the songs a little bit. If we're asking if we can hear the sobriety, I don't know, because it's really rough around the edges. Like this, like if you would have told me these guys were messed up on cocaine when they cut Bayou Country, like I would have been like, okay, that kind of makes sense too. Like, so I feel like I can kind of be sold either way, but the fact that you say that they're sober, I mean, I know the songwriting's really sharp, so I think that's awesome.
I mean, obviously they performed throughout the 60s with names including the Blue Velvets and the Gollywogs. They landed on Creedence Clearwater Revival in early 68. Buoyed by kind of the modest success of their debut later that year, John Fogerty starts to consider the potential of the band capitalizing on this momentum. So he said in an interview with Pitchfork, "We're on the tiniest record label in the world," which was Fantasy. "There's no money behind us. We don't have a manager. There's no publicist. We basically had none of the usual star-making machinery. So I said to myself, I'm just going to have to do it with the music." And we've talked about John Fogerty quite a bit in the first 10 minutes of our conversation. How integral is his vision to the success of the band and ergo this album? Because it seems like, as you said, it seems very much in his vision, very much kind of what he wants out of an album and out of a band.
I mean, I think we all know, or any fan of CCR knows, that there was like this internal conflict with the band where they were always at odds with everyone else in the band, wanted to write the songs and they wanted to sing on the songs and different things. And like, so it felt like there was always a power role struggle, and John Fogerty always stepped up with the songs and said, "Hey, you know, check out Born on the Bayou, check out Bootleg. Like, here we go. Like, these are songs. Let's play them." You know, I mean, I feel like every band's role or every band's destiny is completely different. It's almost like its own organism with its own DNA. So it's like what works for CCR is probably definitely not going to work for Goodbye June or whatever. It's not like, but I felt like CCR was performing their best when John Fogerty was in control. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, that's from my perspective. I'm just a casual music listener that loves this band and loves John Fogerty's voice, you know, and I can speak from my own experiences, like when you're writing music and like, I feel like every song has to have a leader, right? It has to have somebody with a vision that can kind of put it on their back and carry it forward. And the other members of the band, it's their job to support the vision and make it better than the guy who came up with it, you know? So I feel like hopefully that was what's happening with CCR, but it seemed like John Fogerty a lot of times is that guy with the vision. And it seems like at least from my experience, is that when you have that leader and you have a strong song concept and you have a dynamite band and you have passion for the music and you step into a studio that's a professional recording studio with a great producer, as long as you have that leader that can carry that song forward, you're going to have success in songwriting and success in recording. So,
and I know you used the word swampy before, and I get CCR, they really do get linked with this kind of development of what gets called kind of the swamp rock sound. And, you know, we've already talked about, you know, certain sounds and themes throughout the album on these songs. You've touched on this already. It might surprise some people to know that Creedence were actually from California, so they weren't from the South at all. In Bad Moon Rising, the unauthorized history of Creedence Clearwater Revival, John says all the really great records or people who made them somehow came from Memphis or Louisiana or somewhere along the Mississippi River. I had a lifelong dream that I wanted to live there. The South just seemed to be where all the music that's kicked everything off started from. And I guess that's it. It's, you know, it's very much grounding kind of the roots of American music and the blues and all this kind of stuff. Obviously, yourself kind of growing up in the South, it sounds like that John's interpretation of the South felt really authentic to you. You almost kind of found yourself in those songs and in that music.
Yeah, there was something. I mean, I grew up, my two cousins, Landon was born in Atlanta. Me and Brandon were born in Southern Indiana, which Southern Indiana is not really the South, but it's right above Kentucky, which, you know, might as well be the South. Yeah, I mean, so Southern Indiana is like very rural. You know, it has a lot of qualities like this, like, you know, the South. You know, Landon was born in the South, and I was drawn to that. I had always felt like a kinship towards that music, kind of like John Fogerty did. And, you know, we moved to Nashville 2009, and we've been down here for quite a while. So, yeah, man, the South's seeped into our music, it seems like, me personally. And then, but yeah, I think John was right when he said it, that a lot of the great stuff came, you know, close to the Mississippi. And I think that just says a lot about the blues. I think everyone, there was something about the blues, you know, John Lee Hooker, Freddie King, Albert King, B.B. King, all these guys that were in the South, that they were creating this music that they didn't know it, but it was going to inspire a whole like new genres of music. And just to be close to that or to be in tune with that, I think it's really, yeah, I think it felt like that's what John Fogerty was channeling.
And obviously the dynamic seems to have changed quite significantly since the band's days as the Gollywogs, because once they changed their name to Creedence Clearwater Revival, that's, as we said, where John took control from his brother Tom, knew exactly what he wanted. And this had positive and kind of negative results. So we've talked a little bit about sort of conflict, you know, within the band because of kind of the control that John had. Having said that, it sounds like maybe in these early stages that it wasn't as big an issue as it would be later. Bass player Stu Cook told Classic Rock magazine about the meticulous process of the band in the Bayou Country days that said we'd sit every morning before rehearsal talking about the sound and direction of the band. John suggested that we really mine the roots of rural and urban American black music, which was our favorite kind of music anyhow. We'd all grown up together, listening to it for years. The whole thing of the South gave John great imagery to work with. John led, and each of us was there to do our part in putting this vision across. So while, like you say, even a casual fan of CCR would know that that conflict would lead to the end of the band, it seems at this point, at least, they were all fully behind John and the direction and the sound of the band, which is great.
Yeah. I mean, Foger, it kind of reminds me of a situation of like, in the Eagles, you watch like the Eagles documentary and Glenn Frey's talking about the songwriting. He's talking about how, you know, talking about the singers and how, you know, Glenn Frey personally, he's like, hey, you know, I went out and did my own pop record and I've, you know, had a top 10 hit or whatever. He's like, but we had Don Henley. Right. So, and he said that in the sense of like, yeah, cool. You know, maybe I'm a good singer, but you have this once in a lifetime talent that can be the lead singer of the band. It's like, you got to use it, you know, you got to use them. And I always kind of felt like that's how Creedence Clearwater was. It's like, it's cool. You guys want to write and you want to arrange. And I'm sure, you know, there's ebb and flows to that in your career, but it's like, but you got John Fogerty, It's like, dude, just let him do his thing, because it's like when he's doing his thing, man, it's good.
Yeah. I think as well, and this might surprise some people knowing this kind of fact that the band were from California, very much kind of songs of the South. I love the honesty of this album, particularly kind of in the sound of it. So we've talked a bit about it being quite a raw album, you know, kind of maybe, for lack of a better term, kind of underproduced. I guess these studio techniques were still being developed in the late 60s and they didn't really rely on that studio trickery. So I've got another quote from Bad Moon Rising where John says, my basic philosophy is that you've got to have it sounding like what you want right there in the room. That's where it all happens. Then it's up to the engineer and the producer, who was me, to get it down on tape. It was no accident that we got that sound. We all felt that it had to have the muscle and the subtleties we were looking for. And we've spent a lot of time looking at snare drums and going through bass strings and bass amps and all that. The idea of fixing it in the mix is totally foreign to me. Same with singing. I'd go in there and probably do two takes and that would be it. Do you think that's when you were talking about this album being a little more raw, a little bit more rough around the edges? Do you think that's what it is? There's kind of like an honesty and an experience in the room that's kind of shining through on Bayou Country.
Yeah, I think so. I think it feels, you know, now that you say that, it's like, it does feel like just a great live record. I've cut to tape, so I know how cumbersome, the process of editing on tape can be. So like we've cut our new record that just came out, we cut that to tape. And and when you do that and you commit to that style of production, it's like, you need to have a major focus on the live room, meaning like, the band's got to be well rehearsed. It's really difficult on tape to take a band in there and then like rehearse or write it in the studio. It's just, you can't really do that just because it's so cumbersome editing on tape. So, you know, you'll spend half the time in the studio rewinding, rewinding the literal tape. So it makes sense that John's saying that of like, you know, you got to go in with a laser focused direction an idea on what you want to do, and then you need to execute it when the light's red, which is, to me, it's the toughest part of recording. And I finally figured out that, like, when people say they're a recording artist, I've never got that when I was growing up. Like, I never understood, like, oh, I'm a recording artist. Okay, why would you say that? You're an artist or you're in a band or whatever. Like, but what's funny is, like, the more records I record, it's like, oh, I get it. There's like an art is when that red light comes on. It's so funny. Like, it's like all this cool stuff I practice and want to do typically goes out the window, and it just comes down to like this primal, all your bad habits come out, you know? And it's like, it can be a good thing, could be a bad thing, but it's funny. Like, so, sorry, that's a long winded roundabout way of saying, yeah, I feel like this record Bayou Country is raw, direct. It's
it feels well rehearsed. It's just like a great live record is what it feels like to me.
Yeah. And it's interesting to just to get a bit more of an idea of that kind of that process in the studio. Best classic bands explain that it says they say ever since he took control of the four piece from his older brother, John Fogerty was used to showing the band exactly what he wanted them to play and how a process he called pre-production, in emulation of filmmakers, he also picked out certain guitars and amps that would give his own work the sonic signature he insisted on. This demanding leadership style brought constant friction to the band, and over the years, Cook Clifford and Tom Fogerty felt belittled, their contributions to recording and songwriting virtually erased every time John gave an interview. So while it's all very, you know, again, this wouldn't be the album. It is, like you'd said, every band has their own journey and their own kind of setup, if you like, their own DNA. But, you know, that must have been a challenging environment for the other guys to work in. Again, going back to that Eagles example, when you've got someone world class like John Fogerty, but wanting to be able to put your voice on it and wanting to be able to contribute.
Yeah, it's got to be tough. I mean, even in my personal experience, like me, Landon, and Brandon, my two cousins, we are the songwriters of the band. So we can write complete songs by ourselves, right? And then we'll bring them to the band. And it wasn't always so clean and nice. We didn't understand our individual roles so well, probably early on. And I feel like that's one of the biggest to-dos, like a checklist, is if you're in a young band, is like, it's like, hey, let's figure out everyone's role in the band. And not saying that role can't change or develop or grow, but it's just like, let's try to figure out everybody's role right at the top so that you can avoid your ego getting hurt, or you can avoid, you know, some of the pitfalls, I feel like, that can happen to early bands. So like, I know at least for us in Goodbye June, I mean, me personally, like I've written songs that I think in the moment, oh my God, this is a great song. This needs to be on a Goodbye June record. And to be honest, and looking back, it doesn't. And it was my ego that couldn't accept that. And I know me, Landon, and Brandon have all had those kind of experiences of like, you bring forth, you know, what you feel like is your heart on a platter, and the other guys like will listen to it, and they listen to it like the rest of the world listens to it, because they've never heard this song before. So, you know, they ingest it, and then, you know, in the first 20 seconds, you can tell in their eyes and in their body language that they're, hey, they're not into this song. They don't like it. And it's like, that's really tough to handle. And like now as a songwriter, me personally, going into a new record, I need to have like, I'll typically try to write 12 to 15, like I'll try to write around 10 to 12 songs. And a song doesn't have to be completely complete. It just needs to have basically a verse and a chorus and maybe some lyrics, maybe some vibes of sort of where I want to go. And out of those 10 to 12 songs, I mean, I'd be ecstatic if three or four of them make it on a record, right? And that process has taken me a long time to get to, because I used to think, as a young, you know, dummy, it's like, oh, all 10 or 12 of these are gold. Like I wrote the record, you know, and it's like, that's just not the case. And it's not if you want the best, that's not the case at all. Like you need to like, you know, go through your, really take an inventory of what it is. And it's so funny. It's like that your answer is in the eyes of whoever you're showing it to. You can tell in the first 10 seconds. Is when I sit down and start playing and singing a song on acoustic, I could stop after 10 seconds and be like, okay, you're not going to like this song. Like, you know, let's go to the next one. Or, okay, you like it. Like, let's work on this. Let's make this better. Let's start all contributing. Let's all work on these lyrics. And like, you know, I mean, I feel for the other guys in the band, Creedence Clearwater Revival. And I know that feeling that they feel of, you know, having what you think is a great idea and then presenting it to the group. But I mean, it's like, I don't know, if I was sitting back and I was the bass player in the band of Creedence Clearwater Revival, and I was sitting back and I was listening to Bayou Country and I heard Born on the Bayou, or I heard Bootleg, and I would feel intense pride that I was just a part of this project. And then I would be like, all right, John's got it. John has a vision. I'm just going to support him for a while. I'm going to like, let's see how far we can take this vision. And then like, you know, as an artist, like when like you're in a vibe and you're writing a record and you're writing in a style. And it's like I never understood it growing up. It's like, man, why didn't these guys write, you know, 10 Born on the Bayous? You know, like why didn't they just keep going, you know, keep going? That's just not the case. It's like, it's impossible to do now that I've created my own records. It's like, if this latest record we just put out, See Where the Night Goes, like if it goes on to be the most commercially successful album we've ever done, which it seems like that might be the case, my younger self would be like, oh, let's just keep doing that. Let's keep creating that. It's going to be easy. What's funny is like when you're creating records like this, especially in the style of like going to tape and trying to create this live record, it's like that record is a once in a lifetime. Like it's that moment, and you can't recreate that moment ever again, no matter how hard you try. You cannot recreate that moment, and it's a disservice to try to. So it's like, I feel like, I know for us, it's just like, you got to do the absolute best you can in that moment. Once that moment is passed, then you try to catch another wave. You know, you try to write another incredible record, and you try to set yourself up to catch another wave, so that when you're in the studio with the red light, it's like, and that red light comes on, you catch that wave and you ride it and you create another great record. And I don't know, like, I would love to hear more about like the other guys in the band. It seemed like they were dissatisfied with, you know, their contributions and different things, but man, the proof's in the pudding, dude. It's like, listening back to some of the stuff, it's like, God, I'm a part of this band. I'm a part of CCR. I that might be enough for me.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah. I don't know. It's hard to say. Like I said, every band's different. Every journey is different.
And I guess with the songs on Bayou Country, Creedence Clearwater Revival, they went from this kind of up and coming band to Woodstock headliners, chart favorites. You know, this album reached number 7 on the Billboard 200. Green River, of course, later that year, would be another huge album for them too. Why do you think it's Bayou Country? I know you'd said, you know, this feels a bit more raw. It feels a bit more kind of a band just kind of playing together. Why do you feel this is a more important album for them in terms of laying the groundwork and establishing these other amazing albums that they would record over the next few years?
Yeah, I think it set up this vibe. It set up the swamp rock vibe, and it set it up really well. I mean, Bootleg, Keep on Chuglin'. I remember I have little notes. I have this little notebook because I was when I found out I was going to do this podcast, I was like, oh yeah, I want to do Bayou Country. And then I was re-listening to it, and I have these little notes like by Bootleg. I said, what's he saying? what's he saying? Like, I have no, like, and I remember as a kid not really knowing all the lyrics he was saying. And, you know, he didn't really talk like me or sing. And like, he was kind of, I don't know, making up words isn't the right thing, but it's just how he was singing. And it's like, what's he saying? Like, it doesn't even, I think this record set up this vibe that it was free. And it was this, I don't know, man, it's just this band from another, just another place, another station in life, another, just a distant place from me, in Southern Indiana. When I was listening to it and I put it on, and I would just be like, man, where are these guys from? I mean, are these guys from, you know, swamps in Florida? Like, where are these guys from? I don't know. Like, there's just something like oozing out of this music that it compelled me. And I feel like it started to shape my appreciation of musicians and of art, and realizing that, holy crap, this is really special. When these guys got into a room and created music, it was, no one else in the world could sound like that.
Yeah.
And it started making me like appreciate and listen closer, and at the same time not really like put so much of an emphasis on me needing to understand absolutely everything that was going on in the music. Like I said, I didn't know what he was saying half the time, which is incredible, you know, that it still made that kind of impact on me, even though I don't know what Chuglin means. Anybody know what Chuglin means? It's like, but I was like, God, this is cool.
Yeah, exactly. It seems like the perfect time to go track by track and dive into some of these. So we'll start with the opening track that we've talked about quite a bit, Born on the Bayou, immediately setting the scene. Backseat Mafia save the song. Bayou Country starts with an almost sinister rising hum that opens Born on the Bayou. And over the course of 5 minutes, CCR established themselves as one of the leading lights of late 60s American music by way of swampy rock and roll vibes that countless Southern rock acts would emulate over the next 5 years. For you, kind of, again, if you're putting the record on or however you choose to listen to it these days, how does Born on the Bayou kick off the album for you?
I mean, perfect. Like the opening riff and then the feedback into it. I mean, just the opening guitar riff it immediately transports you to somewhere else. Like it's, again, somewhere I didn't know existed, like just some deep swampy place. And I loved it. And again, that's one of those songs that the first time I heard it, I picked up a guitar and I'm like, what's he doing? And I spent a while like plunking through stuff. And I finally found it. I found what he was doing. There wasn't a lot of bands that I could do that with, that I was listening to back in my youth, you know? So it's like, it immediately had a big impact on me. And that song, particularly Born on the Bayou, is probably one of my favorite songs that they do.
I mean, John gave some context for this song in the 2012 book, Finding Fogarty, Interdisciplinary Readings of John Fogarty and Creedence Clearwater Revival. So he said, Born on the Bayou was vaguely like Porterville, about a mythical childhood and a heat-filled time, the 4th of July. I put it in the swamp, where of course I had never lived. It was late as I was writing. I was trying to be a pure writer, no guitar in hand, visualizing and looking at the bare walls of my apartment. Tiny apartments have wonderful bare walls, especially when you can't afford to put anything on them. Chasing down a hoodoo. Hoodoo is a magical, mystical, spiritual, non-defined apparition, like a ghost or a shadow. Not necessarily evil, but certainly otherworldly. I was getting some of that imagery from Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters. It's fascinating to get, you know, to get into that insight, isn't it? You know, where obviously we've talked about B.B. King and all these other people, you know, even going to like Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, yeah. Just to hear that process of him just kind of sitting, you know, looking at a bare wall and this all just kind of come into him. It's just such a fascinating opportunity to get that insight into how he wrote this song.
Yeah, you can definitely hear Howling Wolf is a great, 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 great reference. Like I think you hear Howling Wolf on a couple songs on this record.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Born on the Bayou was named amongst Rolling Stone's 100 greatest guitar songs, which is no mean feat, to be fair. What is it about the guitar on this one that is so special that, you know, I was saying this to my wife the other night, that there's, if you watch those early episodes of Friends, you know, they've almost kind of pilfered the riff in this song for kind of transitional scenes because it's so recognizable. It's not the recording, but it's very similar. Like, why do you think that the guitar in this song's become so special and so iconic over the years?
I don't know, man. It's just, there's something about it that just really speaks. And I don't know. I don't know how he got that tone. I'm guessing it's like a 60s Marshall with a tremolo on it, and you're just plugging straight into, I don't know, probably Les Paul or something. It don't seem like a lot of pedals or anything, but I think it's just a beautiful amp and a beautiful guitar cranked up and captured very well. There's just something special about it, and it immediately grabbed me. So, I mean, that's kind of a cornerstone of tone. So even sometimes when we have, you know, mid to slow tempo songs, it's like I can put on some old Fogarty records and try to reference some of those tones and be like, you know, I wonder what he was doing here. I wonder if I can try to get into this world or turn this on its head a little bit and try to come up with something new. So it's a very influential guitar tone.
Yeah. And I know you'd said for you, it's certainly one of your favorite songs. Both Doug Clifford and John Fogarty have revealed that it's their favorite song by the band. You know, would you say that it is? I mean, obviously we've talked about kind of the impact and the influence of it. Does it feel like a career highlight for them, kind of in a career full of amazing songs?
I think so. I mean, I think somebody, I don't know if it's Rolling Stones or somebody, defined Creedence Clearwater as a band of singles, which I don't know if that meant that their singles were so outstanding that the rest of their records, like the B-sides or the deep cuts, didn't stand up to the singles at all. I don't know what they were getting at when they said that, but definitely, like, but man, they have so many great songs. Like, it's a shame to, like, I mean, Run Through the Jungle is another one that was on, I think it was on their next record. And I mean, Run Through the Jungle is a jam too. And I don't know. I just feel like Bayou Country was the foundation, and then they started building on everything and they started refining everything. And I think they started learning the successful things, like Born on the Bayou. They learned probably the mixing and the production and, you know, even the equipment that they were using. I think they were learning something and that they carried on through their next records that I think, you know, maybe they wouldn't have had if they didn't have Bayou Country.
And we'll move on now to a track that you've referenced quite a lot already. So we're going to talk about Bootleg now. Best classic bands call Bootleg a grinding number that epitomizes the swampy drive of musicians like Tony Joe White and Doug Kershaw, mm-hmm. with a whole bunch of acoustic and electric guitars moving around in the mix. So I guess from how much we've talked about it already, I'm guessing it's a firm favorite of yours. How do you feel that it kind of epitomizes that swamp rock sound as they're alluding to there?
Dude, that acoustic in the beginning is incredible. And just the kind of jive of it, the just the way the band is all playing to that kind of swingy, jivey beat it's a clinic on dancey Southern rock. You know, it's a clinic. It's just how to do it. And it's not that hard. It's just it's only a couple chords. And then the lead lines, the melody lines on the guitar is like, it's just not like nothing's rocket science here, but it's just the sum of the parts are so much greater, you know, than the individual pieces. You know, if you'd be like, oh, John Fogerty, you know, is he a great guitar player? And you would say, absolutely. But you put him up against Eddie Van Halen and it's like, okay, well, obviously these are two different things that are happening here. And Eddie is very technical. And, you know, Eddie by himself can just entertain a crowd with just him and guitar, just playing notes. And like, it's you know, inspire, like he can inspire with just notes. And it's like, and then you have a guitar player, like if you had solo the notes of John Fogerty, probably on the mix on that tape machine, you know, maybe it's not that impressive. It's really not. Probably, and it's probably a little sloppy and probably a little weird. He probably comes out of tune a little bit, but there's something about it when you put it in context with the band and his vocal that it makes it elevates it to this. It's just as inspiring as, you know, some incredibly technical guitar player. So, and that's something that I've always appreciated about John Fogerty and CCR is like they kind of gave me a great lesson as a musician of, dude, don't figure out what you are and try to be the best at that. Try to be the best version of yourself rather than trying to chase something. And it's like the more and more songwriting I do, the more and more I perform on stage, the more and more I go down this journey of being a musician is like the more that lesson gets reinforced and the more I realize, you know, as a middle-aged musician or whatever I am, just trying to be the best version of yourself. And I felt like John Fogerty was an incredibly inspiring story about that, of being the best version of yourself and not trying to chase other people's sounds or not trying to chase other things. Just work on, just stare at your apartment wall and envision being somewhere else and trying to write an incredible song about where you want to go. That's like incredibly inspiring because anyone can do that.
I mean, we were talking before there about kind of, what's he saying? What's the song about? You know, what are the lyrics, so to speak? In his memoir, Fortunate Son, John talks a bit about the meaning of bootleg, saying, why is it that those things that are really bad for you, candy, ice cream, alcohol, taste so good? Why is it that things we can't have that we want even more? And the lyric that I've picked out that I really sticks out to me, because like you, I was always a bit like, well, what's he singing here? So, you know, for the purpose of our chat, I thought I'd have a look. And the bit that really stands out for me that I liked was, take you a glass of water, make it against the law, see how good the water tastes when you can't have any at all, which I think sums up the meaning of the song. A really interesting concept when we're talking about the fact that these guys, you know, certainly from a drug perspective, you know, that they were sober. You know, all these other bands were fully living to excess. And then a song like this appears on Bayou Country. Quite an interesting sort of comparison, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Bootleg, maybe it doesn't even, I don't even know if it's talking about drugs and alcohol, you know, mm-hmm. It might be talking about social issues. Yeah. You know, it's kind of like that's the kind of thing is, and, you know, obviously 1969, there was a hotbed of, I mean, I don't know personally, but like, you know, what I've read in the movies and different things is like, it's a hotbed of social change in the United States. So it's like, maybe it's just social commentary.
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously, you know, talking about that change, obviously one of the big things that happened in the late 60s was, of course, Woodstock. Bootleg was one of the songs from Bio Country to make it onto the set list for their Woodstock set. Have you seen any of that performance? Or and if you have, what did you make of it?
I haven't seen the Woodstock performance. I've seen one of my favorite concerts, and it's available on YouTube, is live in Europe, I think is what it was. And I don't even know where the set was at. It's just live in Europe, and it's an incredible performance, like just incredible. It's funny. So I was inspired by John's, John had a real white coily cable that would run from his guitar straight into his Marshall amp. And it'd just be sitting there bouncing during the whole set. And what's funny is we were coming up with music video concepts, and we had just released a song called Three Chords on our latest record. So we're coming up with a music video concept, and I was like, I'm gonna do the John Fogerty bit. Like, I'm gonna have the white coily cable, and I'm gonna plug it straight into my amp, and it's gonna be sitting there bouncing during the performance. And it's funny, like, I've had different people ask me about. People are really worried about this coily cable that I used on the music video. But yeah, that's the bit, man. I was like, dude, it's John Fogerty live in Europe. Like, that was so cool when he did that. And it's like, it's just, it fit that thing fit the aesthetic of this music video. So it's just kind of cool that, you know, his not only his music seeps into a little bit of my songwriting and different things, but it's like, you know, some of the aesthetic too is kind of cool.
Plenty more songs as we go into our track by track analysis of Bayou Country. You can hear the rest of my conversation with Tyler Baker from Goodbye June in just a little bit. As I said at the top of the show, we're going to be celebrating 50 years of Argus in May with Dan Morris from Firekind. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the album and, you know, anything in general, really. The usual places, myclassicalbum.co.uk, fail in that, and just drop me a message. Everything you need is there, to be honest. Just get yourself there. We're also in May going to be joined by Loz Campbell, who has chosen Tori Amos's debut album, Little Earthquakes. And I like it when the podcast takes a little bit of a left turn and we maybe do an album that wouldn't be expected. And I think Little Earthquakes is a really good example of that. But it's an amazing album, absolutely amazing. And my conversation with Loz is a good laugh too. So that's coming up. We've also got, I'm trying to work out where we're going to fit all of this in, which is a nice problem to have. But I'm also going to be joined by Aaron Day from These Wicked Rivers, who's chosen Deja Vu by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. Back in February, we actually did Neil Young's After the Gold Rush with Jack J. Hutchinson. So it was nice. At the time, we talked quite a bit about Deja Vu, and I was kind of like, oh, we do Deja Vu soon. And then it just so happens that we did. So that's worked out really great. I might see if I can squeeze three episodes out in May, but I'll announce that on the social media channels if I get the opportunity. But for now, let's get to some music. Goodbye June is storming it at the minute. Absolutely storming it in the UK. They've not long reached number one on the UK rock album chart. This is from their latest album, See Where the Night Goes, that Tyler's mentioned a couple of times during our chat. It's the opening track, in fact. So sit back and enjoy. From Goodbye June, this is Step Aside.
Brings
So we'll move on to Graveyard Train, a nice moody riff for Graveyard Train, which stretches over 8.5 minutes to end side one. Sound facts save of the song, it's in the style of Howlin' Wolf, an idol of the band and one of the major influences on Fogarty's vocal delivery. I know you said earlier on when we mentioned Howlin' Wolf, you'd said, you know, that's a really good shout, that's a really good comparison. How much of an influence do you think Howlin' Wolf was on John Fogarty?
I think, I mean, I would say, just as not knowing and not reading like his bios and different things, I would assume Howlin' Wolf was a big influence on him, the way like he sang, particularly in this song, Graveyard Train's like, he's really channeling, I feel like, Howlin' Wolf type of vocal. He's singing a little lower. He's singing lower, but he's singing with a great intensity, a lot like Howlin' Wolf did. I had written down Little Red Rooster. And then I also written down Kings of Leon Tranny. That was on their first record. Tranny is one of the weirder blues songs. But like, this is just me, complete speculation, but it's like, I kind of can cut a line between Little Red Rooster, Graveyard Train, and Tranny. You know, I can cut a line between those three songs. I think it's kind of interesting. Again, complete speculation. I have no idea, but something about that simple, slow blues riff that just kind of lingers on, and then you have these big, powerful vocals between the notes. It's just a formula that's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, again, to give us a bit more kind of insight into the sessions, I guess, John told Hit Parader about how they recorded Graveyard Train. So he said, I even sat down to do that one. I sang from a music sheet with cues for myself written out. The lights were down and I just sat there, like being in my room when I was a little kid. I couldn't even see the other guys, just me and the mic in the darkness. I had to keep my guitar from coming into the vocal mic and I had to pick up a harmonica and play that too. It was very awkward. We couldn't do that on a song like Good Golly Miss Molly. And it's weird. I can almost hear that in the song. I don't know about you.
Yeah. Yeah, dude. You just hear it. You hear the plunky clunkiness of it. It's just this massive rock that like is trying to roll down the hill, but it just keeps getting stopped. And then it just rolls a little more. And it just keeps like, it's just this like begrudging process, and it's cool. It's really neat.
I mean, a blog called The Listening Post, they praised the song, saying, I think the slow pace and repetitive melody adds a certain hypnotic quality, offering a perfect backdrop for the bluesy harmonica to strut about. And I get that, like I say, you know, almost hearing it. I mean, I was even this morning, kind of before we started chatting, I was just getting a bit of tidying done in the house this morning and listening to the album, and this came on, and you just get kind of lost in it, sort of sucked into that kind of, you know, repetitive in this instance is a really positive quality, because it just kind of just really reels you in, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I mean, we've talked a bit, you know, you'd said, was it Rolling Stone had kind of called them like a singles band, and I'd said earlier on about this kind of tightness and focus and such. Graveyard Train is a different proposition. As I'd said, you know, this is one of two songs on the album where there's a bit more of a jam into it. It clocks in at over 8 minutes. Do we get more opportunities like throughout their career? Do we get many opportunities to hear them kind of break loose like that and jam a bit? Or is this quite a rarity for the band?
Well, I mean, from my perspective, my knowledge of their discography or whatever, it's like, I know Graveyard Train, I know Chuglin, I think there's some jam versions. I feel like definitely live that they jammed out more, because that was cool at the time. So I totally understand. Like, I've seen some live versions of them jamming out songs, like taking a 3 minute single type song, making it a 6 or 7 minute song. I think that was commonplace at the time, and you know, so yeah. But yeah, not really. I mean, what's funny is the, you know, if you listen to their beloved songs or their most commercially successful songs, it's like they clock in pretty typically 3 minutes or under.
Yeah. And I think our next one's a good example of that. So, you know, we kick off side two with a cover of Little Richard's Good Golly Miss Molly. So this was already, I mean, it was released in 1958, Little Richard's version. So it was already a really iconic, well-known song at the time. Hundreds of artists have covered it since, but I'd argue that this version is probably the most famous kind of recreation. What do you think that CCR do to make this song their own?
I mean, the guitar tone in this song particularly is just piercing and incredibly unique. like as a guitar player myself, when I listen to Good Golly Miss Molly, I'm hearing like a lot of like Freddie King going down, mm-hmm. like that style of like piercing, ultra trebly, ultra vibrato, like vibrato that's just so quick that it gives like this chaotic feel to it. It's such a, to me, it's such an iconic song. You'll hear interviews throughout time and artists kind of say the same thing, but the one I can think of the best was like Trent Reznor saying that Johnny Cash, you know, Johnny Cash's version of Hurt, which is a Trent Reznor Nine Inch Nails song.
Yeah.
You know, that was the real version of that song. Johnny Cash did that song better than I did. Little Richard and CCR are obviously two way different things, but I feel like as far as covers go, this is such a strong cover that I think it falls into that category that Trent Reznor was talking about of like songs that it's like sometimes an artist will take a song and just turn it on its head and make it transport it to a whole different world that the writer of the song probably didn't even know existed. And yeah. I think that's what's happening on Good Golly Miss Molly here.
Yeah. And I mean, we've called it a cover. I mean, you discover music, they say that it really isn't a cover at all, but a reworking of the classic rock and roller that gets the full CCR treatment. And I guess that's it sometimes. And it's never said with any kind of disrespect, but I think sometimes just calling it kind of a cover version is a disservice to the song. And I think this is a good example. Like I say, do you think it makes sense more to call it like a reworking, a reimagining, whatever?
Reimagined, that's great. I mean, all I know is it feels like they gave a cover the full creative treatment that they gave like Born on the Bayou, or they gave one of their originals. And that's what you want as an artist when you're doing a cover. I think Ozzy Osbourne said it best. You got two options when you do a cover. You either completely change it and make it your own, or you do it as close to the songwriters, like as close to, as you can, as they did it. And I think to be successful, it seems like the most successful covers are more, you know, reworking and re-envisioning it and transporting the song into a new place that, you know, no one even knew existed. You know, so, and I think that's what's happening here.
And it's funny because you would think, obviously, we've talked so much about John's vision and all this kind of stuff, that you would almost think if you hadn't heard this album, that putting a cover version in there would kind of affect that. But I think, one, they've done such a good job of making it their own. But I think that, two, obviously, with Little Richard, of course, being born in Georgia, it makes sense that if they were going to cover a track on this album, it would come from someone with that Southern background and that Southern history.
Right.
And I mean, I might be wrong here, but from my research, I couldn't find any evidence that Good Golly Miss Molly was released, at least by CCR, as a single anywhere. Do you think that was a missed opportunity, or do you think it was more of a wise move to, obviously, there's some amazing songs on here that John wrote. Was it a better move to release those?
Yeah, I don't know. You never know why. I mean, sometimes bands can just, you know, like a cover might pop up because the live set needs some energy, or the live set needs something like, okay, well let's cover this. Let's record this Little Richard song. So people know it. So when they come to the concerts, when we, you know, have this high energy song, you know, people will obviously know it and be familiar with it. But so you never know like why bands are doing certain things. It could have just been, they could have been doing it for the live set. They could have been unconfident that Born on the Bayou or Bootleg were great songs. They could be like, man, let's just make sure we have a hit on this record. Let's make sure Good Golly Miss Molly is going to be dope. We're going to cut it. It's going to sound great. And like, let's just make sure we have one. So sometimes, you know, the reason why it might not have been a single is because the success of the other songs, you know? So like there's maybe a plan B is maybe a bad way to think of it, but it's like, hey, you know, at least we got one hit on here.
Yeah.
You know.
So we'll move on to Penthouse Pauper. So you discover music. They call it another excellent song that has some searing lead guitar from John Fogerty against the solid rhythm section of Doug Clifford's drums and Stu Cook's bass, serving as a hallmark of the band and the album. So by no means would I say this is the best known song on the album. Do you think it's something maybe of a hidden gem? I think that's, you know, I think it's maybe quite an underrated song on the album.
I think you see them stretching their legs and trying to really do some proper blues that is unique to them. And it's just really them
as a swamp rock band diving into more of a truer blues song is kind of how I receive it. So I wrote down Freddie King. I know I've said it a bunch, but there's something about Freddie King and John Fogerty that there's just a line between those two guys that, to my ears and my guitar, like my knowledge of guitar playing, it just seems like those two guys are you know, there's an energy with both of them that I think rings true. So yeah, Penthouse Pauper, I think, falls into that. Just them stretching their legs as a blues band.
I mean, Best Classic Bands, they really dive into this one, saying it features John's pace and guitar tone, very much in the style of Quicksilver's John Cipollina, probably indicating he switched from his normal Rickenbacker to a Gibson for the track. Clifford's aggressive punctuation is perfect, maybe his best playing on the album. I mean, in terms of the drums, would you say, is this a highlight or the highlight for Doug Clifford on drums on Penthouse Pauper?
I think tonally the drums are incredible on that track. The drums are really good through all of it, but I think Penthouse Pauper is a little bit more of a standout. So yeah, I would agree with that.
I mean, if I was going to make any criticism about the song, and it's almost a compliment rather than criticism, is for me, it seems to fade out just as things are getting started. Like just as you really kind of getting into it seems to fade out. Do you think that Penthouse Pauper, do you think it could have benefited from a longer run time, something like Tooglin or Graveyard Train, maybe a couple more minutes just for the band to let loose?
Yeah, it could. Of course it could. I mean, any song like that is really geared to jam out, but it's a tale as old, you know, a great lesson for bands to learn, and you hear it here, is that you leave them wanting more. You know that's the classic way of thinking, of leave them wanting more.
So we'll move on to a truly iconic song now with Proud Mary. This would prove to become the breakthrough song on Bayou Country. It found life beyond the album as well. Before we dive into it too much, what makes Proud Mary such a special song, do you think?
I think it's the storytelling. Proud Mary is iconic, and it's like it transcends genre, you know, as you see in like Tina Turner covering that. And see, Tina Turner did a better job than Creedence Clearwater Revival, in my opinion. You know, she like took it and made it, elevated it, right? Brought Proud Mary to the masses. So I think the storytelling of Proud Mary is what carried it through and made it the best. It was the best song on the record.
And I think, I mean, to be fair, we're on like 60 odd episodes of My Classic Album at this point. When we get to these really iconic songs, what we often find is the inspiration just strikes. Like, it's just almost as if someone from the heavens has kind of just handed this song over. And this is another example. So John says, he said, "I've been trying to get out of the army, and on the steps of my apartment house sat a diploma-sized letter from the government. I went to the house, opened the thing up, and saw that it was my honorable discharge from the army. I was finally out. This was 1968 and people were still dying. I was so happy. I ran out into my little patch of lawn and turned cartwheels. Then I went into the house, picked up my guitar and started strumming. Left a good job in the city, and then several good lines came out of me immediately. By the time I hit rolling, rolling, rolling on the river, I knew I had written my best song. It vibrated inside me." And again, it's like I say, sometimes it just seems like the greatest songs, they're just meant to be. The example I always use is the riff in Sweet Child of Mine that Slash was just messing around on the guitar. That became one of the most iconic riffs in rock history.
Right.
This is another example of that, I think.
Yeah. Great art comes from great inner turmoil or inner like excitement or jubilation. And I can only speak from personal experience. I'm not going to say put myself on the same level as John Fogerty as far as songwriting or whatever. I'd never do that. But from personal experience, I know that there's times like in the pandemic when we lost all of our shows and I lost my income for the year and I was trying to figure out like money, all that news kind of hit at one moment. And that night I wrote like one of the songs on, well, a big part of one of the songs on See Where the Night Goes record called Black, which is just probably one of our fiercest songs, right? And it's like, and it just flowed out of me like so quickly, right? So I'm starting to realize as a writer is like the best songs are typically when you're going through some really crazy stuff or really exciting news. There's like the internal balance is off kilter, and I feel like if you channel it, you can channel. That's when you make great art,
And I feel like that rings true through painters. I think it rings true through tons of different forms of art. And I think especially music. And it's funny that you say that he wrote his best song after learning he had got discharged from the military, right? So it's like, man, you're going through the hardest time in your life, or you're going through the most exciting news. It's like, dude, pick up a guitar and try to make people feel the way you're feeling. And that's a great lesson in songwriting and a great lesson in trying to create art, you know, in a truest sense.
I think there's a sweet irony in the fact that obviously we've talked about Good Golly Miss Molly, that they've picked a really well-known song to cover. And then Proud Mary would become the flip side of that, that many people would cover that. And we've already talked about Tina Turner, so Ike and Tina covered it. And it was just 2 years later. Obviously, that is one of her signature songs. You've already said you feel that she actually improved on this and kind of built on it. What is it about kind of Tina's version of Proud Mary that you think sort of improves on that and kind of builds on what we hear here?
Well, because this is maybe sounds really dumb, but I felt like Tina was Mary, right? Mm. And I felt like John Fogerty was singing about Mary, right? So when Tina did it, and she was like belting out Proud Mary, I received that like she's Proud Mary. And I feel like, you know, most of the greatest songs in history come from that perspective of like I and me. Like when you're writing, the song is referring to I and me. So when she's saying Proud Mary, she's referring to herself, which makes me relate to it and makes me like I'm like rooting for Proud Mary, man. I want her to win. I think that was maybe the biggest difference. I don't know. Maybe it's a psychological thing, or maybe that's just how I personally received it. But I think that was one of the biggest. I mean, and dude, she crushes it. The instrumentation, the energy is level 10. You know, Proud Mary's kind of this mid-tempo, just cool, rocky thing for CCR. Whereas when Tina did it, man, she just like, it was level 10. Is, you know, and obviously, you know, the outfit she wore was iconic in the music video, and the whole thing was iconic. So,
yeah, absolutely. And I think it's funny because, you know, when I think about that, you know, and obviously I discovered the Tina version of Proud Mary before the CCR version kind of growing up. And for me, I think you're right. Like when I heard that, like Tina is Mary, you know, whereas when John's written it, Proud Mary is actually about a riverboat. You know, which right. is, you know, so it just shows you that kind of that difference in there. And I've read that the opening chords of the CCR version, they're meant to evoke a riverboat's paddle wheel going round. You know, do you think that comes across in the music on the CCR version?
I mean, I'm kind of nodding my head now that you say it, but I'd never really thought of that.
Neither had I really until a few days ago, but there you go. I think surprisingly, Doug Clifford, he wasn't a fan of Proud Mary, and he told Goldmine, "I didn't think it was that good. If you want another truth about it, I just didn't like it. I liked Born on the Bayou. To this day, it's still my favorite Creedence song. It's nasty, and I was disappointed when the single got flipped." So for those who don't know, Proud Mary was released as a single, and Born on the Bayou was the B-side. You know, with all due respect to Doug, you've got to wonder, I'm quite interested. I would love to be able to kind of sit down with him and say what it was about Proud Mary that he didn't like compared to some of the other tracks on the album.
Yeah. When he said he defined Born on the Bayou as nasty, like I get that. I know what he's talking about. It's just nasty. Proud Mary, when you receive it as a listener, it's like, it's a little cooler. It's a little more chilling on the river, you know, and maybe just Doug likes his CCR nasty.
I mean, the CCR version of Proud Mary reached number 2 in 1969. Both versions that we've been talking about have received Grammy Hall of Fame awards. So CCR's version went into the Grammy Hall of Fame in 1998, Ike and Tina's version in 2003. And then to top it off, Proud Mary ranks this number 155 on Rolling Stone's list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. So before we move on to our final track, why do you think, I mean, to be fair, we're talking over 50 years at this point. Why do you think this song has resonated in such a huge way? And how much of that do you think is Tina's version? Or how much do you think it's just kind of the song and the message of it?
I think it's both. I think John did a great job of storytelling, and I think John did a great job of putting us all on the river. And then I think Tina just she just gave it legs, man, and kind of injected some sex into it, if that makes sense. Like CCR's version has no sex in it. And it's like all of a sudden Tina comes along and it's like, oh, mama, like this is electric. I think those two forces working together is like, that's why it's one of the best songs of all time.
So we'll move on to our final track on the album, Keep On Tuglin'. Backseat Mafia say of our closer that Keep On Tuglin' is where the band hit a relentless groove and follow it unwaveringly for well over 7.5 minutes. In lesser hands, it might have been a track that dragged, but somehow they keep it vital and vibrant, minting their first killer album closer and ensuring that Bayou Country is untroubled by a weak spot. Do you think, I mean, to be fair, like we said, sometimes we do these episodes and there is the occasional filler track where my guests might be like, you know what, I'd probably skip that one, or this is a bit, you know, there isn't, like, it's all killer, no filler, I think, this album. But do you think there's a danger that in the wrong hands, a song like Keep On Tuglin' could have felt a little bit like a dragon?
Well, meandering is like a terrible adjective when it comes to music. You never want to meander, which means just kind of like walking around with no purpose, right? So it's Keep On Tuglin' has like everyone's saying, it seems like it could very easily meander because it's not that complex of a song. It just kind of chugs in this mid-tempo way, but they just, I don't know, man, just Tuglin'. Like, what does Tuglin' mean? And I want to spend 7 minutes learning about what Tuglin' is.
Yeah. And it's funny you should say that, because again, we discussed this earlier, this word Tuglin', which has been somewhat popularized by the song. Many believe John came up with it himself. He's been quoted as saying that it's what happens when you get to ball and have a good time. Stu Cook says he thinks it's a metaphor for sex. If obviously, you know, we don't, but we neither of us know what it means. If for you, if you were to try and guess, what do you think Tuglin' means, or what does it mean to you?
I mean, Keep On Tuglin' to me is like keep on rolling. It's like keep on, let's keep on going. That's how I kind of perceived it. But I like sex, and I like partying. So that's kind of cool too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know you'd say you were talking about that kind of CCR in Europe performance that you really enjoyed. Keep On Tuglin' was often the set closer for many of their concerts. And like you'd said, that would be one with a jam that'd stretch it out to maybe kind of 15 minutes. On that one that you've seen, have you seen any performances of Keep On Tuglin'? And, you know, is it kind of the perfect way to end the set?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Like, I've always been in the school of thought is like you kind of close with the strongest song to leave people wanting more and to make sure, you always want to end on an exclamation point, you know, and Keep On Tuglin' isn't really that exclamation point, but I think it could be something that where like people would have a lot of fun, like dancing, partying, summing up the night. So, wouldn't surprise me if they closed.
But in terms of the album, how does Keep On Tuglin' end the album for you? How are you feeling? Where are you at when we get to the end of this song?
Yeah, like a lot of bands and a lot of bands want to end a record typically on like a ballad or like maybe their weirder song or maybe a song that artistically doesn't fit the rest of the record. I've heard that a lot with different bands. But Keep On Tuglin' was just, to me, Keep On Tuglin' is like a great opener to the record almost. Like that's like the one, it like gets you into the headspace of what this record is. And the fact that they closed with it, I think is a pretty cool artistic choice because it just cements this swamp rock, this train that just keeps on rolling.
So bolstered by the success of Proud Mary, Bayou Country became one of the first of three huge successes for Creedence Clearwater Revival in 1969 alone and sealed their fate as one of the biggest bands in the world at that time. So while they'd ceased to be by the end of the 70s, their legacy remains untarnished, even deep into the new millennium. You know, we're 20 odd years in and we're still talking about these albums. Far Out magazine sum up the impact of Bayou Country. They say it all seems so simple of Bayou Country. CCR owned 1969 like no other band did. And from the very beginning too, when it was released in early January of that year, Bayou Country signaled Creedence Clearwater Revival as the forerunners of what would take over popular rock music in the forthcoming decade. And it's hard to imagine bands like Little Feat Lynyrd Skynyrd and Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers would have sounded like had CCR not laid the foundation. I mean, with that in mind, why do you think this album has stood the test of time?
Just the sum of all its parts is so much greater than the parts themselves. It's like you just got a dynamite vocal, you got a dynamite rhythm section has a super unique tone, but yet it's not overproduced, it's not perfect, there's mistakes, you can hear things that like aren't perfect in the recordings, and the guitar tones and just the choices that these guys made, it just makes like there was no other group of people in the world that could have created this record. And the fact that this record came out and had its day in the sun, and a lot of the songs went on to have much longer, more influential lives, is just a testament of like kind of how important CCR sound was.
And finally, why is Bayou Country your classic album, and why should people check it out if they haven't already?
You should check this record out because I think it connects a lot of dots. I think it shows, gives a lot of inspiration for Southern rock bands. I think it just Americana. This is a great Americana record. And I think the vocals are dynamite. And I think there's just something about, there's so many lessons to be learned. You know, me as a musician, I try to be picky about what I ingest and what I let myself ingest and be influenced by. And this is one of those records that I think has left its DNA into my thought processes, and like left its DNA into how I approach music and what I appreciate about music. And even the recording process, I really value these kind of choices and these kind of chances that they took, and this kind of simplicity. Like I value it. I just think it's a great record to put on at a barbecue, that's for sure.
Well, Tyler, thanks so much for joining me to chat about an awesome album. You know, I'm surprised we haven't done a CCR album earlier, to be perfectly honest. So thanks for being the first one to pick one. Obviously, we've talked quite a bit about Goodbye June and See Where the Night Goes. I know it's obviously just hit number one over here on the rock charts, which is amazing. What are the plans for Goodbye June throughout the rest of 2022?
2022 is we're starting a tour in April with our friends Whiskey Myers, incredible Texas rock band. We're going to be doing, I think, 17 shows with them. And then we're getting some of our own headlining shows in the United States. Those are going to be popping up. Right now we're working on a European headline and run support date, and also festivals in the summer. So that's our plan right now. We haven't announced any of that yet, but we're working hard on trying to put all that together. We have a Mad Cool Festival in Madrid, I believe, Madrid, Spain. And then we have Best Pop in, that's another major festival, I think, in the Netherlands. Sorry guys if I messed that up. But we're definitely going to try to make it over to England. I heard little rumors, rumbling of Rambling Man at one point.
Cool.
So we'll see how all that develops. But we're going to be doing a lot of touring, a lot of support for this record. Never would have thought this was going to be a number one record in the UK. But, I mean, y'all stepped up and seemed to really respond to it. So we're super humbled. And check it out. If you like rock and roll, if you like this kind of music, if you like modern rock, I mean, you just like rock and roll, check it out, because we put a lot of heart and soul into it. What's funny is a lot of these techniques and a lot of these ideas, you know, the ethos, the spirit of like Bayou Country, I feel like you can hear that a little bit of that in our record, See Where the Night Goes. So I think there's something special there. And I kind of did that because like I hear a little bit of ourselves in this, not necessarily the sound sonically, but just the approach and some of the choices that we made. I feel like you can draw a line between, you know, our record and this record. And so anyways, I just want to thank you, Mike, and thank you, the fans and the community that you're building, music listeners, music appreciators. want to say thanks to all you guys. Thanks for having me on, man.
A special thanks to Tyler Baker from Goodbye June for joining me to talk about Bayou Country, his classic album, here on the show. And obviously you heard the track halfway through the show there from Goodbye June's latest album, See Where the Night Goes. Just reached number one here on the UK rock album chart. I've got to say, they really do have a really loyal fan base here in the UK, and they're absolutely paying that back. I just wanted to kind of just quickly tell this little story, really. This, you know, obviously here on My Classic Album, we interview people from all over the world. You know, we get British musicians, American, Canadian, Sweden, all over the place, you know. And so it's not unusual for me to have to interview people at weird and wonderful times to meet time difference. You know, that's the life of doing a podcast, I guess. Tyler was pretty insistent that we did the podcast his time, 6 a.m, which I'd think, I was like, are you sure? Like, yeah, I don't mind doing it later. That's no problem. You know, I'm used to doing podcasts a bit later for people in the States. And it was because they know the success they've had in the UK. They're so grateful for that success in the UK that they're making that effort to appear on shows like this, to appear in kind of British media for interviews, for promotional opportunities, all of that kind of stuff. So, you know, I just wanted to give that shout out to Tyler for, bless him, you know, waking up, you know, before 6 a.m. for our interview. But I guess you start the day right, don't you? Have a bit of a chat about Creedence Clearwater Revival, and that's going to set you up for the day. So thank you very much to Tyler for taking that time out. We did have a bit of a chat as well about maybe one of the other guys coming on the show in the future, or Tyler maybe coming back to talk about another album that we had on the cards. So, you know, if you're a Goodbye Jude fan, you know, make sure that you're keeping an eye on the podcast, because I'd like to think we'll have one of the guys on again. But I'll do it for another episode of My Classic Album. There's some great albums coming up, as I said. Don't forget, we're going to be looking at Argus. We're going to be looking at Little Earthquakes. We're going to be looking at Deja Vu. Some great episodes coming up over the next month or so on My Classic Album. Next in line is the 50 Years of Argus episode with Dan Morris from Firekind and Martin Turner from Wishbone Ash. Again, please get your thoughts in on that album. I'll read out as many as I can on the show. But until then, I've been Mike Norris, and I will see you for 50 years of Argus. Cheers.